Today's episode will touch on sensitive topics, such as child death. So if you are sensitive to this content, please listen at your own discretion. What is art without the muse? Many of Western art's most famous works are depictions of women. But who were these women? Do they have their own stories to share with the world? Hello and welcome to Art Muse, a podcast that aims to reshape the ways in which we interpret well-known works of art by paying dues to the women whose images have been immortalized, but whose names and stories have been wrongfully overlooked. While these women's faces are familiar to viewers around the world, their identities have been largely forgotten. Together, we will explore the important lives and legacy of the female muse and appreciate these works of art from a new perspective, through the eyes of the women whose image stares back at us. Is the muse in actuality just as, if not more, important than the artists themselves? And I'm your host, Grace Anna. For listening purposes, I want to clarify before I begin that in this episode, artist James McNeil Whistler will be referred to by his first name, James. James's father, George Whistler, will be referred to as Whistler. This decision was made to honor how Anna McNeil Whistler herself would have referred to her husband and son, respectively. The only time James McNeil Whistler will be referred to as Whistler is in the title of his most famous work, Whistler's Mother. Whistler's Mother is one of the most recognizable images in the world. If you are like me, you may have first come across Whistler's masterpiece in the Mr. Bean movie, a humor-filled fictional film in which Mr. Bean accidentally damages Whistler's mother and replaces it with a reproduction. All jokes aside, Whistler's Mother is one of the most iconic paintings in the history of art. And similar to the Mona Lisa, it has taken on a life of its own, its meaning morphing and changing through different periods of history. Its malleable meaning is due in part to its mystique, leaving the viewer with endless questions. Is James Whistler's portrayal of his mother sympathetic or critical? Is the painting's sentiment warm or cold? And is Whistler's mother an intimate portrait of an individual, or is she symbolic, a monument to motherhood? As Whistler's mother sits there with her hands crossed and gaze distant, she seems to safeguard the secrets of her portrait with her quiet but defiant reserve. Though Whistler's mother was painted in England and has been on view in Paris for over a century, it is inarguably one of the first great American works of art, informing the work of later American legends like Andrew Wyeth and Edward Hopper. And more than this, it has carved its way into the American consciousness, acting almost as a relic of America's Puritan roots. Depending on our perception of America's past, Whistler's Mother can elicit feelings of both nostalgia and resentment, as the painting makes us reflect upon our own complex relationship with America's beginnings. On a more universal scale, Whistler's mother has become an important symbol of motherhood. Though she is Whistler's mother, she feels like a mother to us all, a familiar and all-knowing presence that brings a comfort only a mother could provide. We can almost hear the whistle of a tea kettle ringing in the background, and smell the fresh scent of cookies from the oven, ready to be served. While Whistler's mother has continued to captivate the imagination of viewers through the centuries, the name and story of Whistler's real mother has been wrongfully overlooked. Who was Whistler's mother? And how would she have liked to be remembered? Today, I share with you the story of Anna McNeil Whistler, not only the mother of James McNeil Whistler, but also his artistic manager and agent. One may judge from her portrait that Anna was a stern and restrained woman who lived a simple life, but but doing so would be a great injustice, for Anna was far from an ordinary woman who lived a far from simple life. Though born in the South, Anna spent her adolescence in Brooklyn, witnessing its maturation from farmland to the beginnings of the city we know today. She married an innovative railroad engineer who was so impressive that the Tsar of Russia hired him to build a railway in St. Petersburg, where Anna joined him with their young children. When her husband died of cholera, Anna showed immense resilience and moved back to America as a widowed mother. Never staying in one place for too long, she eventually moved to England to evade the Civil War, where she lived out the rest of her life. In her lifetime, Anna crossed the Atlantic Ocean a staggering 11 times, testament not only to her itinerant lifestyle, but also to her adventurous spirit. And of course, Anna was a mother. If we look at her children alone, Anna not only raised one of the greatest artists of our time, but her other son became a well-respected physician and her stepdaughter an acclaimed pianist. Anna played a crucial role in each of her children's lives and was a steady force in the shaping of their destinies. James Whistler owes much of his success as an artist to his mother, who tirelessly promoted his work, saw impressive commissions in both America and England, was the liaison between her often irritable son and his clients, and managed his finances. And though her portrait came about by chance, it is only fair that James Whistler paid rightful dues to his mother and her integral role in his success by immortalizing her image. But more than anything else, Anna was an immensely strong and independent woman, resolute in both her faith and unbending character. She showed great resilience in the face of continued challenges. The loss of three of her five children, the untimely death of her husband, and having to raise two sons as a widow for the remaining 32 years of her life. These hardships did not stop Anna from living a bustling life, interacting with impressive figures of history such as Tsar Nicholas I and Robert E. Lee, making friends in all of the many places she lived, and astutely observing the world around her. She was Whistler's mother, but she was also so much more. So without further ado, I present to you Anna McNeil Whistler. Anna McNeil was born on September 27, 1804, in Wilmington, North Carolina. Her father, Dr. Daniel McNeil, was a well-respected physician, originally born in Scotland. Dr. McNeil was married with children before meeting Anna's mother. He was living in Wilmington with his first wife during the Revolutionary War and was a staunch loyalist to England. When the British lost, Dr. McNeil had to flee with his family to the Bahamas in exile. While in the Bahamas, Dr. McNeil's first wife passed away. When it was safe for him to return to America, Dr. McNeil sent his two daughters to live with his parents in Scotland and made his journey back to Wilmington, where he would meet Martha Kingsley. Anna's mother, Martha Kingsley, was a beautiful and intelligent woman originally born in New Jersey. Her family had an equally scandalous background. Her father had been a successful merchant, plantation owner, and slave trader in Charlestown, who, like Dr. McDaniel, was a staunch loyalist to England. As tensions rose, Martha's mother was sent to New Jersey, where Martha was born. When the war ended, her father's property in Charlestown was confiscated, and the family fled to Nova Scotia for 6 years, where Martha spent her childhood. They eventually returned to America and settled in Wilmington. Martha was introduced to the widowed Dr. McNeil, and they were soon after married. By the time Anna was born, her parents had established themselves in the upper middle class. Her father was a successful doctor, and the year after Anna was born, he sold a plantation to his brother for a sizable price, adding to the family's wealth. It is important that we not overlook the fact that Anna was born into a southern family of slave owners, and in some cases, slave traders. As a young girl, Anna would have witnessed slave auctions in front of Wilmington's courthouse, and she visited her uncle's plantation every summer. We know that Anna's father owned at least two slaves during their time in Wilmington. Despite accounts that her family instilled in Anna the importance of treating the laboring class, including slaves, with respect and kindness, there is no getting around the fact that her family participated in and benefited from industrial slavery. Anna had three older siblings and eventually two younger siblings, making her the fourth of six children. By all accounts, she enjoyed a happy childhood. Wilmington was one of the busiest seaports in the nation, and Anna would have spent her earliest years watching ships coast down the Cape Fear River, which she could see from their porch. She would have been woken each morning by the cacophony of sounds from the seaport, and if she ran down the hill from her house to the riverbank, she would have been engulfed with bustling activity. Little did Anna know that she herself would sail from this very river to distances she could have never imagined, on not one, but several different occasions in her life. Though Anna wouldn't have received an extensive education, she would have had a tutor who taught her basic reading and writing. Her education's focus was likely on the skills believed to be most important to girls at the time, like music, singing, and dancing, as well as how to run a successful household. She would have also received a religious education, and the important role of women as society's missionaries would have been impressed upon her at an early age. One of the benefits of these lessons was the emphasis on Anna's ability to read religious texts and write in good penmanship, two skills that served her for the rest of her life, as Anna was not only an avid reader, but always wrote long letters to family and friends. In 1814, when Anna was 10 years old, her family moved from Wilmington to Brooklyn, New York. By some accounts, Anna's father moved their family up north because he could no longer stand the brutality of slavery. But this is very unlikely the reason for their relocation. As per surviving records, Anna's father still owned slaves at the time that they moved to Brooklyn. And we know that he sold two slaves in 1817, a few years after their move. It is more plausible that Anna's family moved north because Wilmington was hit hard by the War of 1812, and businesses began to plummet. The family likely chose Brooklyn because Anna's maternal grandmother and aunt both lived in New York. Still a young child, Anna likely would have felt a comforting similarity between Wilmington and Brooklyn. The docks of the East River reminiscent of Wilmington's busy ports. Anna's family settled in the affluent neighborhood of Brooklyn Heights. They lived in a large four-story wood frame house with a high front porch on Hicks Street. Their block was lined with elm, mulberry, and cypress trees. We can imagine little Anna running down her porch and weaving herself through the many tall trees as she made her way to the river, where she could catch the sunset over Manhattan. When she first arrived in Brooklyn, it was no more than a simple village, measuring barely a square mile. It was filled with houses, taverns, and stables, and beyond the village's border were long stretches of farmland. Over the next few years, Anna would witness Brooklyn grow exponentially. In 1814, when a ferry system was established between Manhattan and Brooklyn, Anna enjoyed a multitude of new shops near her home, including butchers, grocers, and carpenters. By 1818, she watched as Brooklyn's first streets were paved and its first street signs erected. And in 1824, by the time Anna reached her 20s, she would have seen the opening of Brooklyn's municipal court. Anna likely continued her education in Brooklyn, learning basic mathematics and science. By the time she was 12 years old, both of her older sisters were married off, and Anna would have been in charge of taking care of her two younger siblings. Anna proved to be a responsible and attentive older sister. She may have even taken her younger siblings in 1820 to see a 70-foot whale carcass that had washed up along Brooklyn's shores. She had an especially close bond with her younger sister, Kate, who she remained close with for the rest of her life. Anna grew to be an intelligent and vivacious young lady, with a wide circuit of friends. But all the friends in the world could not prepare Anna for the whirlwind of falling in love. When Anna's older brother William was sent to West Point Academy, he would bring his friends back to Brooklyn with him on breaks. One of his friends was a young man named George Washington Whistler. Whistler was enrolled as a cadet at West Point, notorious for his pranks and mischievous behavior. When Anna spotted the dark, curly-haired Whistler walking through the front door of their Brooklyn home, she was immediately swept off her feet. She knew she had found the man that she wanted to spend her life with. But there was one major problem getting in the way of making Anna's fantasy a reality. Whistler was in love with somebody else. And to make matters worse, in 1821, when Anna was 16 years old, Whistler eloped with his love and got married. Anna was so crushed by the news that she made a promise to herself to never marry anybody else, enveloping herself in an all-consuming sadness. Anna distracted her wounded heart by spending time with her many friends. But her heart would once again break when a few years later, Anna's father, Dr. McNeil, passed away in 1828. Anna was only 24 years old when she lost her father. She would not only say goodbye to her father, but also to Brooklyn, where she had spent the last 13 years. After her father's death, Anna moved with her mother and siblings to Baltimore, where her brother was working as a topographical engineer. And as fate would have it, Anna's father was not the only recent death in her immediate circle. But George Whistler's first wife had also recently died of typhoid, leaving behind a widowed Whistler with his three young children. Whistler became a frequent guest at Anna's house, turning to her brother for comfort as he grieved his late wife. Anna could not believe that she was once again face to face with her first and only great love. Whistler must have noticed that Anna had matured into a beautiful young woman, with golden brown hair and dreamy gray eyes. Anna soon warmed her way to Whistler's affection, and the two grew close. As legend goes, Whistler's first wife told him on her deathbed that if he were to ever marry again, it should be with Anna McNeil, who she knew as a family friend. While likely untrue, Anna was slowly but surely carving her way into Whistler's heart. But Anna soon realized that Whistler was too devastated over the loss of his wife to pursue the serious relationship she so greatly desired. Feeling increasingly impatient, Anna arranged her first trip abroad to visit her half-sisters in England. In October of 1829, Anna embarked on her first of the 11 trips she would take across the Atlantic in her lifetime. Though only 25, Anna boarded the trip unchaperoned as a single woman traveling on her own. How did Anna feel as she set sail for lands unknown, completely on her own? Was she nervous to leave behind the familiarity of her family and home? Or was she excited to embark on a new adventure, abandoning her troubles over Whistler and her hopes for marriage? The journey on boat took a grueling 14 days to arrive in England. In her first surviving letter, Anna wrote to her sister Kate, "A ship is the school to teach patience." Luckily, the taxing expedition proved to have a warm reward. Anna's half-sisters greeted her with a wholehearted welcome. Though many years her elder, Anna felt an almost seamless connection with her half-sisters, who reminded her of her late father. Anna continued to write letters home, filled with sharp observations of the new world around her. In many of these letters, Anna inquired about Whistler. She was hoping that absence would make the heart grow fonder, but was disappointed to receive few letters from Whistler himself, who was preoccupied with work and his children. It must have taken Anna a great amount of faith and resilience to navigate her feelings from Whistler from afar, with so few certainties and assurances. But it seems that Anna's time away worked in her advantage. When Anna returned from England, Whistler, overwhelmed by his life as a widowed parent, was finally ready to settle down. And who better a partner than Anna, who had set her heart on Whistler since she was 16 years old. Anna was caring, had a good sense of humor, and was ready to accept Whistler and his children with open arms. And so, on November 3rd, 1831, Anna married George Whistler. Though she was 16 years old when she first fell in love with him, Anna's dream had finally come true at the age of 27. The ceremony took place in Anna's brother's home on Bond Street in Manhattan. How did Anna feel as she exchanged vows with the man she had waited for over a decade to marry? Was she pinching herself that her fantasy had finally turned into a reality, despite all odds? Or did a small part of Anna always know that she would one day marry the love of her life? Soon after their wedding, Anna and Whistler settled into their new home in Paterson, New Jersey, where Whistler was working for the railroad. Their marriage meant that Anna was now the primary caretaker for Whistler's three children, aged 6 to 9, who moved in with them. Anna not only looked after Whistler's children as if they were her own, but she showed immense sensitivity towards Whistler's first wife. She saved his first wife's recipe book and cooked for the children the same food their mother had once made for them. In fact, Anna kept this recipe book with her for the rest of her life, bringing it with her to each and every one of her many homes. Though Paterson was further from her family and friends than Anna may have hoped for, she and Whistler built a loving home together. The more time they spent with one another, the more they found they had in common. They shared a love for music, placed high value on their spirituality, and both kept up to date with public affairs. Even though Whistler had to commute 30 miles on horseback to the railroad every day, he always made sure to be home for dinner and to tuck his children into bed. After 2 years in Paterson, Whistler was relocated to Lowell, Massachusetts, as the chief engineer for the Lowell-Boston Railroad. This would be the first of many moves that Whistler and Anna would make as a family. And the itinerant nature of Whistler's work was one of the many things that Anna lovingly accepted. It is here in Lowell that Anna gave birth to her very first child, James McNeil Whistler. James was born on July 11th, 1834. Though Anna had grown accustomed to her role as stepmother, we can only imagine how much baby James meant to Anna as her first child of her own. 2 years later, on July 22nd, 1836, Anna birthed her second son, William. James was thrilled to have a younger brother who he could play with. Given their growing family, Anna would have employed a cook, chambermaid, and laundress. This did not stop Anna herself from cooking, especially fond of making puddings. She also employed a gardener, as Anna had a keen interest in flowers and vegetation. She would have been in charge of the household and directed each employee in their tasks. Anna was known to be particularly caring to her household staff, often remarking, "The law of kindness holds its gentle sway." When Whistler completed the railroad, the family once again packed up and moved, spending a few years in Stonington, Connecticut, and then later in Springfield, Massachusetts. Anna gave birth to her third son, Kirk, and her fourth son, Charles, in 1840 and 1841, respectively. Anna must have been counting her blessings. She was now the mother of four healthy boys. Her husband was quickly becoming one of America's leading engineers. And they had built a loving home in all of the many towns they had had the pleasure of living in. But what comes up must come down. And Anna's world would soon be turned upside down, literally and figuratively. Both great adventures and heartbreaking tragedies Anna could never have imagined were in her near future, and her life would never be the same. In April of 1842, Whistler was invited by Tsar Nicholas I of Russia to build a railroad connecting St. Petersburg to Moscow. It was the most important job Whistler was ever offered, and the pay was astonishingly high. Whistler was so thrilled by the proposal that he wrote to friends, "I have not felt this happy for a long time." But Anna, who had always supported her husband, was growing increasingly unsettled over the prospect of moving to the other side of the world, to a land completely unknown to them. Whistler traveled to St. Petersburg ahead of Anna to officially accept the offer. As Anna was preparing to say goodbye to America and the family and friends she would have to leave behind, she would also have to say goodbye to her son, Kirk. In the midst of the moving frenzy, and without her husband by her side, Kirk contracted scarlet fever and died less than a week later, right before Anna's eyes. Mourning her life in America and now also her dear son, Anna must have felt that the ground was rapidly falling out from under her feet. A year after Whistler's departure, Anna and her three remaining sons left America to join him in St. Petersburg. Though we can imagine Anna boarded the ship with apprehension, her three boys were thrilled to be going on the adventure of their lives. The ship docked in England, and Anna and her sons traveled through the night by coach to Germany, where they would board their final ship to Russia. Anna later remembered, "Never in my life have I enjoyed a ride as much as the hours that night. The stars shone brightly, and James and little Charles were as bright as the stars." Tragically, little Charles would soon be joining those stars in heaven. On their last leg of their journey, Charles fell ill on board the ship to Russia. The usually energetic 2-year-old boy grew lethargic and refused to eat. Anna cradled her son through 2 sleepless nights until he passed away at dawn in Anna's arms. Charles was the second child of Anna's to pass away within a year, and without her husband's presence and support. When Anna, and now only James and William, were finally reunited with Whistler on September 28, 1843, it was far from the happy meeting they all imagined. Charles's death posed several logistical issues. Russian health officials forbade the body from entering St. Petersburg, so his body had to be sent back to America on a return steamboat. He was eventually buried next to his brother Kirk, a burial Anna herself was not able to attend. It's hard to imagine the unspeakable heartbreak Anna felt as she placed her dear boy's body on a ship to sail back alone to the country she herself so longed to return to. Charles's death completely shattered Anna's well-being. She was able to move through her grief of her first son, Kirk, by caring for baby Charles. And now that they were both gone, her heart was left with a gaping hole. The back-to-back deaths of her two youngest sons would leave a permanent effect on Anna and her understanding of the fragility of life. Anna wrote to a friend, "There is a chord in a mother's heart of such exquisite tenderness, which vibrates to memory, awakening mingled pleasure and pain, fondness and sorrow, that none but a mother who has outlived a darling child can understand." Anna, resilient as she was, began to focus her attention on settling into her new life in St. Petersburg. The unnerving cold and wet air must have felt like a projection of her dampened spirit. The family moved into a large house provided by the Tsar himself, equipped with a team of servants. Their house was located in an area known as the English Quay, and Anna was pleased to find many other English and American expats living in their vicinity. It didn't take long for Anna to find a circle of friends, and she soon began to host musical evenings at their home. Many of the shops in her neighborhood sold imported English goods and catered to English speakers, which must have soothed the cultural transition. That winter, Whistler took Anna and their boys to visit the Tsar's Winter Palace. Anna was taken by the beautiful architecture and impressive art collection. Walking around the snowy city, Anna found St. Petersburg to be the most breathtaking city she'd ever seen. She loved the large public squares, colorful buildings, and grand palaces. Their house was insulated and kept the family warm through the winter, which wasn't as severe as Anna had feared. And the boys were thrilled to find more snow to play in than they ever could have imagined. That spring, the family enjoyed a two-month-long Easter celebration with street carnivals and carousels. And that summer, the family rented a country estate surrounded by wildflowers and a large pond. They were even able to visit Catherine the Great's palace. After such a hard year, Anna and her family deserved to enjoy the splendors of their new life. Anna wrote long letters to friends and family all through her time in Russia, most of which survive today. She also kept a detailed diary, which she intended to give her boys when they were older, so that they could remember their adventurous years together in St. Petersburg. These letters and journals provide some of our most in-depth insight into Anna's inner world, her perceptive observations of her surroundings, how she spent her days, and of course, her various feelings about their life abroad. We know from Anna's diary that she woke up early every morning for her daily prayers, that she would set a daily menu with the household cooks, and then instruct her boys in their studies. Anna hosted Sunday school in their house, not just for her boys, but for any children in the neighborhood who were interested in joining. We also know that Anna studied Russian, as well as French. By their second year, Anna had grown fond of St. Petersburg. In August of 1845, Anna gave birth to a baby boy named John. We can imagine the birth of John would have been healing for Anna, as she still grieved the loss of Kirk and Charles. She drew her greatest joy from her children, who remained at the center of her life. Because Whistler was the Tsar's chief engineer, their children were given special treatment and perks. James, who exhibited impressive artistic talent at a young age, was granted special access to the Imperial Academy of Fine Arts at only 12 years old, where he received complimentary private drawing lessons. But in 1846, Whistler insisted that they send James and William to military school so that they could get a proper education. The brothers were sent to a school in Paris. Anna, feeling the pangs of separation from her boys, and with Whistler often absent due to work, suddenly felt incredibly alone. Her only companion was her newborn John, who provided Anna with unconditional love and a sense of purpose. Tragically, that mid-October, her baby John died of an infection. Yet another devastating blow. With her elder sons away, and her newborn now unfairly ripped from her arms, Anna was near inconsolable. John would be the third of Anna's children to die, and the last child she would ever birth. Out of concern for Anna's well-being, as well as James's poor health, Whistler decided to withdraw James and William from military school and bring them back to St. Petersburg. Anna was thrilled to have her two boys back, their laughter and exuberant energy once again filling their home. But the Russia they returned to was changing at a rapid pace, and Anna began to notice an influx of economic inequality and the growing shadow of the oppressive Russian state. There was an increase in censorship. Russian newspapers were biased and filled with propaganda, and letters in and out of the country were opened and examined. If the concerning political situation wasn't enough, a deadly influenza also went rampant in 1847. Not willing to risk the health of her two surviving sons, Anna decided to leave St. Petersburg for England until things blew over. Anna, James, and William spent the next few months on the English coast. James passed these months making drawings of the English cliffs and declared to Anna his desire to be an artist. Their timing in England was fortuitous, for Anna's stepdaughter, Deborah, had just met an Englishman and was wed in London, a wedding Anna was thrilled to be able to attend. But when Anna got word that her husband's health was declining, she immediately planned her return. Because James's health was also fragile, she decided to leave him in England with her stepdaughter, while she and William traveled back to Russia. Upon her return, Anna learned that Whistler had contracted both influenza and cholera and was suffering their lingering effects. Perhaps even more damaging was Whistler's over-demanding work schedule, which left him malnourished, exhausted, and in a constant state of high stress. Anna tried to help her husband by mailing his letters and copying documents on his behalf, but the Tsar's unrealistic expectations depleted Whistler almost entirely. Even in the most trying of times, Anna was a present and committed mother, exchanging up to 15 letters with James in a matter of weeks to ease his concern for his father. But despite all of Anna's efforts to revive her husband, caring for him day and night, Whistler's health only worsened. On April 7th, 1849, George Whistler died of heart failure, the result of being so overworked and the unshakable effects of cholera and influenza. Anna was by Whistler's side until the moment he took his last breath. On his deathbed, he promised Anna that they'd meet again in heaven. Her last words to him were, "We have but one heart and mind." Anna had lost the love of her life, her husband of 18 years, but the apple of her eye for far longer. The man she had followed across the world, her sturdy rock that had gotten her through the hardest of heartbreaks. She was thrust into unimaginable emotional pain. And for the first time in her life, her belief in God was shaken to its core. At just 45 years old, Anna had become a widow and would remain a widow for the rest of her life. Anna was so distraught that she remained in bed for weeks, too weak to leave the confines of her room. But after a period of mourning, Anna was able to slowly regain her strength. She trusted that every misfortune in life was also an opportunity for self-growth. Anna wanted to rise to the occasion, for her children and also in honor of her husband's legacy. Though the Tsar offered Anna the option of remaining in Russia, without Whistler, there was little reason to do so. Anna longed more than anything for the comfort of her friends and family back home. She had Whistler's body sent to New York and prepared for her move back to America. Once the winter's ice had thawed enough to permit travel, Anna and William boarded the first ship out of St. Petersburg. As it happened, the first ship departed on May 19th, which would have been Whistler's 49th birthday. How did Anna feel as the ship pulled away from the place she and Whistler had called home for the last few years, the place she had said goodbye to her husband and kissed his head one last time, the place her husband took his final breath? After picking up James in London and spending some time with her stepdaughter, Anna returned to New York on August 9th of 1849. She went directly to Stonington to give Whistler a proper burial. He was buried next to his two sons, Kirk and Charles. His body was so badly decomposed that they were unable to have an open casket. Shortly after the funeral, Anna moved with her boys to a small town in Connecticut. Anna's mother, a fellow widow, also moved in with them. Whistler's death meant a drastic change in lifestyle for Anna and her family. Now, Anna's only income was the small sum of money from Whistler's investments, paid annually. Though the Tsar expressed his condolences, he only paid Whistler's salary up until the day he died, which left little revenue from their time in Russia. The family mostly lived off their modest savings. The boys, once treated like princes, were now expected to help with household chores. Anna and her mother handled the cleaning and cooking. While many women would have despaired over their close to impoverished standing, Anna turned lemons into lemonade, enjoying the simple pleasures like growing her own flower garden. Anna's mother became her best friend, not just in helping her run their household, but by comforting her grieving heart. They spent 3 years living together in peace and comfort, until Anna's mother suddenly showed signs of a sharp physical decline. She passed away on April 7th, 1852, 3 years to the day since Whistler's passing. Anna's husband and mother now shared the same day of death. Without her mother's aid, Anna's primary focus became finding her sons a proper career path. Concerned that James could not support himself as an artist, Anna decided to send him to West Point Academy to follow in his father's footsteps. To secure William's future, Anna helped him apply to Columbia University, which he was admitted to. It didn't take long for Anna to receive complaints of James misbehaving and failing at his studies. He miraculously made it through his first year, largely due to his mother's continued emotional support. With both of her sons settled, Anna was able to focus on her own declining health. Anna developed sharp pains in her side and general weakness. She decided to travel to England for a few months to convalesce. The day before she left, Anna got word that James had been sent to the hospital for gonorrhea, making it clear that even the prestigious West Point Academy could not quell her son's mischievous antics. We could only imagine that Anna boarded the ship to England, both deeply concerned and disturbed. Anna not only recovered in England, but she attended London's first ever photography exhibition and viewed a collection of watercolors by Turner. These experiences may have primed Anna for soon accepting her own son's artistic talents and desire to be an artist. For when Anna arrived back in America, both of her sons' lives were in a state of upheaval. William had dropped out of Columbia and become a mechanic for the Baltimore Railroad, a job that got him both addicted to tobacco and hardened his personality. And unsurprisingly, James was dismissed from West Point Academy just after the start of his second year. When James turned 21, he inherited his portion of his father's inheritance and decided to move to Paris to study painting. Anna was taken aback by his rash decision and worried that her son would be so far away. Ultimately, Anna accepted his decision, honoring her son's autonomy. It would take Anna some time to adjust, but she eventually became her son's biggest advocate and played an integral part in the start of his career. She took a genuine interest in James's art and began encouraging her friends to commission works. She requested that James send her prints of his etchings so that she could give them proper inventory numbers. And when James received a positive response for his first painting shown at the Royal Academy in England, Anna encouraged James to stay in London and work on building an English clientele. With James abroad, Anna could focus on getting William back on track. She convinced him to return to school, and he eventually studied medicine at the University of Pennsylvania to become a doctor. If Anna couldn't be proud enough, she was even more thrilled when William got married in 1860 to a woman Anna not only approved of, but genuinely adored. She may have had a bohemian artist as one son, but her other son had finally secured himself a stable future. But 1860 would not only bring the happy union of William and his wife. It was also the start of one of the most significant conflicts in the history of America, the Civil War. The Civil War would prove to be one of the most difficult periods of Anna's life. She felt torn over her conflicting allegiances. On the one hand, she was a Southern-born woman, with a history of slaveholding on both her father and mother's side. Her uncle had owned a plantation, and she had several surviving family members still living in Confederate states. On the other hand, Anna moved north as early as 10 years old and did not have significant contact with slaves. And more than this, her northern-born late husband was not only a strong patriot, but also a Whig member, and would have almost certainly supported fellow Whig member Abraham Lincoln. To complicate her feelings further, William decided to move to Richmond and join the Confederate Army as a surgeon. James alternatively voiced his support of the Union from England. Anna's own views were likely more complicated. As a white Southern-born woman from the early 19th century, she would have inevitably been raised to believe in black inferiority. At the same time, Anna was a firm believer in treating people with kindness and fairness. In a surviving letter, Anna wrote, "I am no advocate of slavery," but then proceeded to defend the morality of slave owners, claiming that she has known slave owners to treat their slaves with care. Though never fully committed to either side, it should be noted that in the end, Anna did end up sympathizing more with the Confederates. As the war worsened, Anna decided to join James in England until tensions abated. We do not know exactly how Anna traveled to England mid-Civil War, but it is likely that she took a steamboat from New York. Upon her arrival, Anna moved in with James, who, in a frenzy to prepare for his mother, had to kick out his longtime mistress and remove his many inappropriate belongings. But to his pleasant surprise, Anna was charmed by James's decor. She especially loved his Persian rugs, Japanese prints, and Oriental doll collection. And it didn't take long for Anna to take charge of James's household upkeep. While he worked in his studio, she would tend to his garden or write long letters to family and friends back home. While James had to forfeit some of his social liberties, he appreciated his mother's help maintaining his house and her support of his career. William also eventually joined Anna and James in England. His wife had tragically died of scarlet fever, and he had grown tired of the relentless bloodshed of the war. Though he risked his life to get there, posing as a Unionist so that he could board a steamboat from New York, William made it to London safely in 1865. Anna was thrilled to once again have both of her sons under the same roof. But because boys will be boys, this didn't last for long. James and William fell into a bad crowd and joined a money-making scheme to deliver weapons to Chile. In the end, only James made the journey, and it unsurprisingly turned out to be a failed mission. And Anna herself would travel, making one last voyage to America. In 1867, Anna crossed the Atlantic to visit her remaining family and friends. She was shocked by the devastating effects of the war and the horror stories of atrocities committed by both sides. She knew as she returned to England that she was leaving behind a changed America, and that she would never again return. On her 11th and final journey across the Atlantic, Anna was not only saying goodbye to her country, but to an era in her life. After their various escapades, mother and son settled into their life together in London. Anna helped William set up a practice in Piccadilly. And Anna and James continued to live together amiably, an arrangement that seemed to suit both Anna and James well. Anna not only provided James with maternal comfort, but she began to fully focus on the furthering of his artistic career. Acting as an unofficial manager, Anna sought out new English and American patrons and pitched commissions on James's behalf. When any friends would visit from America, Anna would convince them to purchase one of James's works. She took care of his finances and business correspondences, even negotiating the rent on his studio. And perhaps most importantly, she acted as liaison between James and some of his most important clientele and patrons. Anna herself put it best. In a letter to a friend, she wrote, "While his genius soars upon the wings of ambition, the everyday realities are being regulated by his mother. I am thankful to observe that I can and do influence him. God answered my prayers for his welfare by leading me here. All those most truly interested in him remark on the improvement in his home and health. It is so much better for him generally to spend his evenings tête-à-tête with me." Beyond helping James with his career, Anna began to enjoy some of the social aspects of the art world, befriending many of James's artist friends, including the painter Gabriel Dante Rossetti and poet Algernon Swinburne. Anna would arrange parties for James and his bohemian friends, sneaking upstairs to her bedroom when she was ready to retire. Anna wrote to a friend, "The artistic circle in which James is only too popular is visionary and unreal, though so fascinating." Anna's interest in James's friends seemed to be mutual, as many of his friends genuinely enjoyed Anna's company. It's exhilarating to imagine Anna in conversation with some of the most outlandish characters of London's artistic circle of the time. And soon, fate would lead to the creation of James's portrait of Anna, shifting her role from mother and manager to model. In the period leading up to Anna's portrait, James had hit an all-time low in his career. Even with Anna's help, his work was not receiving the recognition he deserved, and he was running out of clientele to make portraits of. His confidence as an artist was shattered, and he was desperately wishing for his big break. Unbeknownst to James, his big break was right in front of his eyes. But it would take the intervention of fate to make him see that. In 1871, James had managed to win the commission of a wealthy patron. James saw the commission as a last-ditch effort to finally make a splash in the art world. Notorious for being irritable during his painting sessions, James must have scared off his much-needed client, for she stopped showing up for her appointments. Realizing he had lost his model, James fell into a state of despair. Anna, who rarely entered James's studio, since the last time she did, she found their parlor maid posing in the nude, must have made an exception to soothe her son's distress. As Anna once wrote to a friend, "All sons, I believe, come to their mother, in difficulties, to ask help and find comfort." But it was more than comfort that Anna provided. It seemed that her visit to the studio had sparked a surge of artistic inspiration, and she was surprised when the next morning an excited James declared, "Mother, I want you to stand for me. It's what I have long intended and desired to do, to take your portrait." And so began James Whistler's portrait of his mother. Had his model arrived that fateful day, Anna's portrait may have never existed, and the world would be short a masterpiece. We know from Anna's letters and original sketches by James that Anna's portrait was originally intended to be of her standing. At 67 years old, Anna was no spring chicken, and while she tried her best to stand for her hours-long modeling sessions without complaint, she eventually requested that she be seated. As Anna documented in a letter, "I stood bravely, 2 or 3 days, whenever he was in the mood for studying me. And I was so interested, stood as a statue, but realized it was too great an effort." And so James painted a seated Anna with her footstool for her feet to rest. He captured her in the same black dress she wore every day since her husband's death many years ago. We can imagine that as James painted his mother, the black stain of her dress, the frailty of her elder body, and her eyes that had lost much of their visibility, staring vacantly in the distance, that he was reminded of all that Anna endured. The loss of 3 of her 5 children, the tragic death of her husband, and the inevitable loneliness that came with her itinerant lifestyle. And in this portrait, we can feel both son and mother's quiet reckoning with Anna's mortality. It took James 3 months to finish Anna's portrait. James, who was notorious for scrutinizing over every detail of his works, found that he was able to complete his mother's portrait with ease. As Anna wrote in a letter dated November of that year, Jamie had no nervous fears in painting his mother's portrait, for it was to please himself and not to be paid for in other coin. Upon finishing, James exclaimed to Anna, "Oh, mother, it is mastered! It is beautiful!" And he excitedly kissed Anna on the cheek. James's greatest masterpiece was painted alone with his mother, coaxing him out of his most depressed days and in their most private of shared moments. The painting seemed to be driven by divine force, a portrait birthed spontaneously when James's plan had gone awry. Anna herself was in awe at how serendipitous the whole ordeal had been. She told a friend, "I must introduce the lesson experience taught up, that disappointments are often the Lord's means of blessing." Anna was also extremely satisfied with how realistically her son had rendered her. The portrait had an almost photographic accuracy, but she also felt it captured her spirit. Fate not only should be credited for the painting's creation, but also its survival. Shortly after James finished the painting, he brought the painting with him to his most prestigious patron, Mr. Leyland. Upon his arrival, James proudly hung Anna's portrait on Leyland's wall, hanging next to a Velázquez painting. On his journey home, James placed the portrait in a railroad car. Halfway through the ride, the railroad car caught on fire. The flames scorched the painting's frame, but by some miracle, the canvas was left untouched. James Whistler's masterpiece was nearly destroyed just weeks after its completion. but it seems that fate had other plans for the painting. Anna's portrait, originally titled Arrangement in Gray and Black, was exhibited at the Royal Academy. Like most great masterpieces, Anna's portrait was not immediately appreciated. The Academy almost rejected the painting, disliking its muted colors and mundane subject matter. While it was admitted in the end, the painting received less than favorable reviews. James was so disappointed by the Academy's reaction that he would never exhibit there again. Instead, James safeguarded the portrait at his and Anna's home, where Anna enjoyed seeing her painted image on a daily basis. Despite the lack of public praise, Anna was extremely proud of James's portrait of her, not only for its impressive likeness, but as an example of his immense artistic talent. Whenever a friend visited their home, she made sure they looked at James's portrait of her, smiling at each of their compliments. By the time Anna reached her 70s, her health was in a declining state. Her eyesight only worsened. She was overcome with weakness, and she was often confined to her bed. Lucky to have a doctor for her son, William kept a watchful eye on his mother's health. He decided it would be best for Anna to leave London for the countryside, for cleaner and drier air. He moved her to a health resort in Hastings. Though Anna wouldn't know it at the time, she would spend the rest of her life here in Hastings, never to return to London again. Anna came to really love Hastings. In a letter to James, Anna wrote, "I feel better for the serenity of nature. I breathe the soft air with ease, and the deep blue sea beyond the green slopes is so refreshing. I could never weary of such sameness or feel lonely." But she did miss her sons deeply, and was saddened that she could now only be involved in their lives from afar. This did not stop Anna from still acting as James's agent. She was alive to see James's career take off and find the success he so desired. And though too weak to attend the wedding, Anna felt a sense of peace hearing the news that William had remarried. Knowing that her end was near, Anna donated the little money she had left to charity. In her last days, she found a line from a Thomas More poem that James had written down in a notebook. "This heart, my own dear mother, bends with love's true instincts back to thee." Anna, a devoted mother until the very end, must have felt in her heart a sense of fulfillment as she took her final breaths. Anna passed away on January 31st, 1881, at the age of 76. The same day she passed away, James opened his largest show to date of his pastel works. It is almost as if Anna's spirit blessed her son's success one last time. Though James and William traveled to Hastings as quickly as they could, neither arrived in time to say goodbye to Anna. Anna was buried in the Borough Cemetery in London, where William would join her many years later. At the time, Anna's death received little public notice, and she slipped away with the same quiet dignity with which she lived her life. The house that Anna lived with James, in which he painted his famed portrait of her, still exists in London at 97 Cheyne Walk. There survives a cookbook of Anna's, filled with Anna's own recipes, that is available to the public for purchase. And beginning in the 1920s and 30s, early biographies of Anna began to emerge. But, of course, her greatest form of legacy is her portrait itself, a portrait that has not only made Anna's image internationally recognized, but has taken on as exciting a life of its own as Anna's herself. And the painting's biography is essential to Anna's own story. 3 years after Anna's death, her portrait took the same journey across the Atlantic that she herself took many times to America. We can only imagine how delighted Anna would have been to see her portrait return to her mother country, exactly 10 years after its making. Unfortunately, America wasn't quite ready to appreciate Whistler's mother, and the portrait hung in a back corner of the Pennsylvania Academy of Arts, receiving little to no attention. Upon its return, James kept the portrait with him, refusing to sell it even when he found himself in severe financial trouble. But in the 1890s, dealers in Paris campaigned to have Anna's portrait placed in Paris's Musée du Luxembourg. Given that James had trained in Paris and the French had a far more favorable opinion of the work than the English or Americans, James agreed. He knew that the painting would likely be transferred to the Louvre after his death, which he saw as the highest honor an artist could receive. The French government offered James 4,000 francs for the work, a lower price than he had hoped for, but the promise of it landing in an impressive collection was far more important than money. As James himself said, "One cannot sell one's mother." It would still be many years after James's death in 1903 for Anna's portrait to reach icon status. By 1910, she began to be appreciated as more than just Whistler's mother or an elderly lady, but as an ideal for motherhood. A popular English periodical of the time declared Anna's image as, quote, "the mother as the giver of life, the bringer of peace." In 1932, Anna's portrait once again traversed the Atlantic and returned to America. This time, Americans all over the country clamored to get a glimpse of Anna. Whistler's mother made its way to almost every major city in America. A total of 2 million people viewed Anna's portrait, more than 100,000 in New York alone. Even President Roosevelt's mother traveled to New York to see Anna's portrait, posing for a picture in front of it. Mrs. Roosevelt said on the radio afterwards, "I knew it would give his mother great happiness to see her son appreciated and honored by his native land." This time, Whistler's mother's visit to America was fortuitously timed. In the throes of the Great Depression, America was in need of a reassuring image of stability and a reminder of American values. And to put it simply, America needed the comfort of a mother. Anna's poise and all-knowing presence was exactly what her country needed. Though herself long gone, her image lived on as a mother to millions, and her comforting spirit became eternal. Interestingly, Anna's image as a nostalgic symbol of America's past may have been on James's conscience himself as he painted her. James, though born in America, spent only a handful of years actually living there. Anna was James's only remaining connection to the country of his birth. As James painted his mother, he was also painting his motherland, and she may have become in his mind a symbol of both his own patriotism as well as his displacement. She is present yet still feels distant, known yet still mysterious, sentiments we can imagine James felt about America herself. Anna's portrait would visit America three more times, in the 50s, 60s, and 80s. In 1986, the Louvre moved Whistler's mother to the Musée d'Orsay, where it remains today. As recognizable as Anna's image has become, her life story has been wrongfully overlooked. Anna has fallen victim to a vast number of assumptions and judgments made off her image alone, which are often untrue and unfair. She is assumed to be stern and rigid, and yet we know at the time her portrait was made, she had befriended many of James's bohemian artist friends and notorious drunks. She is misjudged as unfriendly, but her unsmiling mouth was likely because Anna wore dentures at the time and was self-conscious about her teeth. In the few surviving photographs, we see Anna's warm smile, and twinkling eyes. And she is misunderstood as simple or even boring. But Anna lived an adventure-filled life, living in more places than can be counted on two hands. So the next time you look at Whistler's mother, think of Anna McNeil Whistler, of her adolescence in Brooklyn, witness to its first streets being paved, of her first love, George Washington Whistler, who she set eyes on at 16 and finally married at the age of 27, of the three of her five children that tragically passed away, of her time spent in St. Petersburg and the untimely death of her husband, of Anna's continued commitment to her two boys, James and William, of her relocation to England during the Civil War, and of her role as not only James Whistler's famed model, but his artistic agent and manager, who can be credited for jump-starting his career. Of course, Anna's ties to slavery should not be ignored in our consideration of her legacy. If we view her portrait as a symbol of America's foundation, we are not only reminded of America's resilience, but also of its darkness. The gray color palette, a subtle but eerie reminder of America's dark roots entrenched with slavery. Slavery that Anna herself bore witness to, benefited off of, and was complicit in, even though she herself never owned slaves. Anna's personal legacy is just as complex as America's herself, and should be viewed in its entirety. James Whistler once said of Anna's portrait, "To me, it is interesting as a picture of my mother. But what can or ought the public care about the identity of the portrait?" Well, today we hope to prove Whistler wrong. We do care. And in fact, without an understanding of Anna and the immense life she lived, how can we fully appreciate the magnitude of her portrait? She was Whistler's mother, but she was also Anna McNeil. And today we honor her as the brave, resilient, forward-thinking woman she was. I hope you have enjoyed this episode on Anna McNeil Whistler. I've included images, resources, and suggestions for further reading on the Art Muse website and Instagram. Art Muse is produced by Kula Production Company. Today's episode was written and recorded by me, your host, Grace Anna. Stay tuned as I continue to share the stories of the women behind some of the world's most important works of art. Until next time, bye for now.